Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Quick reminder that you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, any place that has podcasts. And once again, thank you for all of your support. Our record month in October was really gratifying. I appreciate it. It was a nice Halloween present. So today is, well, this is like, I'm in D.C. this morning, and it feels like the whole town has a hangover, kind of a happy hangover with the Nats thing. But it is giddy. You just can't talk to anybody. It's bipartisan joy, and it won't last. I mean, really, it's like, enjoy it right now. Congratulations, folks. You're going to go back to normal. And in fact, even as we're speaking, the House is voting on the impeachment proceedings. And we kind of know how that news cycle is going to play out. So to talk about all of this stuff, we decided to have a guest who actually knows stuff about stuff, which may seem like a departure. We're joined by Daniel Dresner, a professor at Fletcher School, contributor to The Washington Post, author of The Ideas Industry, and somebody who actually once really shook hands with Mel Brooks.
Yeah, that's true.
That's actually impressive.
That, you know that line from Ocean's 11, the Ocean's movies, about whether or not you shook hands with Sinatra or not? I find with my peer group that the fact that I've shaken hands with Mel Brooks really counts for something.
No, you know, it's there are so many celebrities out there. There's only a few that you pause and you go, really? You know, And it's stature, but also, you know, that you're not going to get a lot of other opportunities for that. So my high point of the week was I was retweeted by Ben Stiller. So that's all I got.
Oh, that's pretty good.
It's what I got. It's for the week. I'm not going to put it on my Twitter handle though. So you've actually gone full Halloween here, because I'm looking at your Twitter page, and you've changed your name to Evil Prof.
Yes, I do this every Halloween. Basically, okay. Every Halloween, I use that moniker of the Evil Prof, and I change my name to Evil Prof.
That sounds like a book that I've written in the past. That sounds like the kind of book that I would write about the Evil Prof. This may be my next book, Evil Prof, by the author of Prof Scam. So I'm just giving you a heads up. I may steal Evil Prof from you.
That is perfectly fine. It's always flattering. You know, in D.C., good people borrow, great people steal. So every Halloween I change it to Evil Prof. And then essentially it's a way in which I can, you know, sort of channel not just my, but let's say every professor's id in terms of dealing with students, which, to be fair, 95% of the time it's a joy to teach. And you know, it's a really, particularly if you are tenure track or tenured, it's a wonderful profession to have. But, you know, there are minor annoyances. And so every Halloween, it's sort of a way to express that in a somewhat over the top fashion.
Yeah. So but it also seems to be a way to mark the rip in the space-time continuum that we're experiencing right now. I mean, do you try to make sense of, do you have these moments of complete disorientation that we sort of know that time has been broken, truth has been broken. It's like, can you make sense of it? I mean, you have to actually go in and talk to students and try to present a somewhat coherent view of the world to them. I mean, good luck.
Yeah. So, I mean, a couple of things on this. First, actually, I'd highly recommend everyone read Catherine Miller, I think, wrote a great essay in BuzzFeed. Last week.
That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. On sort of perceptions of time in this past decade and how they've essentially been scrambled, that we're now operating, you know, she's talking, among other things, about how we're operating on algorithmic time. But the way I experience it is twofold. First, what is terrifying is the way that sort of different aspects of my life proceed at different speeds. So, you know, I'm the parent of two teenagers. And so as a parent, it seems like things are going at light speed. You know, once your children are out of diapers and they start growing up, it seems like, you know, you snap your fingers and suddenly they're in college. And, you know, you snap your fingers and they're almost done with college. So it's you want time to slow down in that respect. On the other hand, looking at the political scene, how do I put this gently? Do you remember when Trump tried to buy Greenland? I mean, I think that was 5 years ago. It could be 10. I'm honestly not sure at that point. I know it happened. I have a distinct memory of it. But it seems like eons ago, even though I actually, believe it or not, think it was technically just 2 months ago.
Oh, we were just having this conversation before we started the podcast. There's a tweet about Steve Scalise, and Jim Swift, who's one of our senior editors, was saying, now, I had to kind of remember that Steve Scalise shooting, was Donald Trump president at that time? And that was actually a long time ago. As opposed to when Trump invited the Taliban to celebrate 9/11 with him at Camp David. That happened, you know.
I got it. I forgot about that one.
Now,
yeah.
See, that's the problem. This, by the way, this is really interesting that you say this, because this the fact that the different parts of our lives proceed at different speeds, I think that's what is so disorienting. And at the end of every week, and I think literally at the end of every week since 2017, I've had this disorienting experience where I can't remember what happened at the beginning of the week. And I don't think I'm alone there.
To be honest, so I think one of the reasons, so, you know, you may or may not be aware, I have this thread called the Toddler in Chief thread.
Oh, I am quite aware. That's why you're on the podcast today, Professor.
Yes. Oh, and did I mention that that's going to be a book coming out in April from University of Chicago Press called The Toddler in Chief, What Donald Trump Teaches Us About the Modern Presidency. But anyway, I think one of the reasons I do this now is not just, you know, to document this, but it's also, frankly, as sort of a historical marker for me to remind myself of things that, as you say, that it's so easy to forget happened. And so as a result, writing this book has been a useful exercise to remind myself of things like the attempted purchase of Greenland or Sharpiegate, you know, which again was just 2 months, I think less than 2 months ago, because I think it happened in September. But, you know, Trump's insistence that the hurricane was going to threaten Alabama. You know, these kinds of stories.
I'd forgotten that one, too.
Oh, yeah. You know, something that was truly so stupid and yet actually triggered two executive branch inquiries because there's, various abuses of process in terms of dealing with that. So another reason that I do the Toddler in Chief thread is that every once in a while I like to review it just to see, OK, what did I miss or what have I forgotten?
Well, it's interesting about this, and you're, for people who haven't seen this, it's like, you'll take Donald Trump seriously when his staff stops treating him like a toddler, right?
This started in April 2017, because if you recall, and I had some sympathy with the argument at the time, there was this sort of aching desire when Trump was first inaugurated to believe it's OK, we're going to return to normality. Trump will grow into the presidency. The nature of the office will discipline him rather than vice versa. And so you had various people like, let's say, Van Jones on or Fareed Zakaria, you know, say this was the day Donald Trump became president, or Donald Trump really grew into the presidency tonight. So the standard line I use in that thread is, I'll believe that Trump is growing into the presidency when his staff stops talking about him like a toddler. And essentially, to get an addition to that thread, you have to have. It doesn't mean anything if Nancy Pelosi describes him in childlike terms, or if a mainstream media pundit does so. To get added to that thread, you have to be a Trump staffer or subordinate or GOP loyalist or treaty ally or GOP member of Congress that nonetheless, you know, someone who has a rooting interest in Donald Trump succeeding as president, nonetheless describing him the way you would describe a petulant 2-year-old.
Okay, so latest example.
That's a good question.
Okay, I was thinking of Brett Hume going on,
and remember?
Have you seen that one? That no, he's not really an authoritarian. He just blusters. Basically, he's just an out of control, unhinged idiot. So, you know, no crime. Let's give him another 4 years.
That was in fact added. That was the 1045th entry. Was the Brett Hume line? Yes. The most recent one is a CNN story. That essentially it's about the NSC staff worried that if they tell Congress the truth or, you know, go to testify before Congress, the president will essentially have a tantrum and ignore all of the NSC staff's advice.
Did you watch the game last night, the Nats game?
Oh, God, yes.
Oh,
yes,
okay. Okay. Did you see the Donald Trump commercial, the campaign commercial?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so what did you think of this? I don't know whether it was the first campaign commercial. I mean, it's rather striking when a presidential campaign has a political ad in October. So, what was your reaction to it?
My reaction to it was that I guess twofold. First, it's mildly amusing in that, you know, what I liked was that they sort of recounting Trump's achievements. And it starts off, to be fair, with, you know, a few assertions that are backed by, you know, they're like footnotes like Bureau of Labor Statistics or what have you. And then he gets to this line about how he stopped half of all immigrants coming into the country or half of all illegal immigrants. There's no, you know, from that moment, it then switches to just, you know, assertions without necessarily any.
Right. I mean, it's Trumpy. I guess the point I was making is though it portrays him as this strong disruptive guy. Oh, yeah. You know, he may be a jerk, but he's our jerk, and maybe this is what we need. Which so in Trump world, he's not only not seen as this whiny, petulant toddler, he is seen as this world changing superhero.
The thing that is striking to me is the particular end of that commercial where, you know, again, and pardon my French here, essentially the ad acknowledges that Trump is a raging asshole.
Yeah.
You know, it says, yes, he's not a, you know, he is the disruptor in chief. And therefore, you know, but that's a good thing. Maybe that's what Washington needs.
But yeah. And I thought that was an interesting appeal is that he is a raging asshole. He's our raging asshole. So they're kind of leaning into it.
Oh, yeah. And I think, to be honest, that probably does work with the base. I don't think that's insane logic to use. And it might very well appeal to voters who are generally so disillusioned by Washington in general. I mean, you know, in some ways it mirrors the 2016 line. I'm somewhat skeptical, though, that it'll actually work as effectively as his staff thinks it is. It might be the best option that they have. But, you know, the question becomes whether voters look at what's happening in Washington and decide, oh, thank God, you know, Trump is disrupting things because really it's bad, or deciding that Trump disrupting things is the bad thing.
Yeah, or they're just exhausted by it, which is my theme is like, can you just the thought when I say five more years of this, don't you feel your shoulders just sag? Like, oh, no, I can't. I've already confessed to Jim Swift that if Trump gets reelected, I'm just getting in the car. I'm going to actually go get an RV and I'm going to go to Colorado and I'm just going to stock up. I'm just saying, no shame. That's going to be my go bag. I'm seriously going to do that.
My hashtag is that, you know, if Trump is make America great again, mine is make America boring again.
I am totally in favor of that. I want to be I want normalcy. I want boredom. I want to never be on cable television again. Seriously.
Right.
I'm good with that.
No. And truthfully, the most frustrating, you asked before what it's like to teach now. I'm on you know, the answer I can give is that, first of all, it what's painful is the degree to which I have to pay attention to American politics. I mean, my training is in international relations. That's normally what I talk about. But essentially, the epicenter of global instability at this point isn't anywhere else. It's the United States. So a lot of IR folks now suddenly have to become American politics experts. And when we're trying to explain to our students what happens, I still remember when I finished the class I taught in the fall 2016, it was December 2016, I closed by simply writing the shrug emoji on the blackboard.
Okay, why don't I talk about the status of the world and some of the things that you have been writing about. And, you know, particularly as we have one NSC staffer after another trooping up to Capitol Hill to, dish what they're seeing in the White House. It's kind of an extraordinary moment when people are looking at one another and going, John Bolton, resistance hero. Is this possible? Where are we going? What world are we living in right now? But first, let's hear a word from our sponsor. Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery. Just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to tryplexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit tryplexiderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's tryplexiderm.com. Okay, we are back with Professor Dan Dresner. Let's talk about this. Speaking of things we've already forgotten about, in terms of the international situation and the status of our foreign policy, remember when the parents of that young British man who had been killed by the wife of an American diplomat visited the White House and the president tried to make it into a thing?
Yes, I do. So the kid was a 19-year-old motorcyclist named Harry Dunn, who was killed by the wife of a U.S. diplomat in the United Kingdom because the wife of the U.S. diplomat was driving on the wrong side of the road in the U.K. And, you know, as a result, killed him. And I think after a preliminary questioning by British authorities, she wound up fleeing the country. She came back to the United States, and the Trump administration claimed that she possessed diplomatic immunity, which nominally the U.S. has the authority to do. But this is rather unusual. It's sort of a violation of diplomatic norms, in that the crime was relatively clear cut. And also, given the relationship between the UK and the US and the relative respect for the rule of law in the UK, you would have expected, you know, her to go back and be dealt with. So the parents of the Dunns have came to D.C. in early October to basically, you know, lobby for their cause for this woman, Ms. Sakoulis, to be extradited back. When they arrived, they discovered that they had received an urgent invitation from Robert O'Brien, who is the new U.S. National Security Advisor to Donald Trump, saying that the president wanted to meet with them, you know, which you can see why this would be potentially an area in which Trump would want to assuage the the anguish and pain of these people. He met with them and then informed them, including their representative, in the Oval Office, that Ms. Sakoulis was in the next room, which they were not aware of. And wouldn't it be great if she could come out and they could somehow reconcile in the presence of Trump and the, as it turned out, White House photographers who were ready to capture this reality
touching
television
reality
moment.
Perfect. Yeah.
Yes.
And they'd
yes,
run,
you know,
and they'd hug. There'd be tears and resolution and over in the corner, a beaming Donald Trump who made it all happen.
Right, exactly. So, you know, this would be the equivalent of you know, Bill Clinton when he was standing and Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat shook hands in the front of the White House lawn. Needless to say, the Dunns did not take this well. they said no. And then they released a family statement saying, and I'm going to quote this, "It struck us that this meeting was hastily arranged by nincompoops on the run, and in particular Mr. O'Brien, who appeared to be extremely uptight and aggressive and did not come across at all well in this meeting, which required careful handling and sensitivity. The family remains open to the possibility of meeting Mrs. Sakoulis one day in the future, but in a neutral and appropriately controlled environment." So this is not a huge foreign policy thing. I mean, it was one of these stories where, again, with the insanity of the news cycle, I think it lasted maybe a half day.
Right.
You know, it got buried under all the Ukraine stuff.
But it was a tell.
Yeah, it's a huge tell. So it's worth stepping back and thinking, what are the implications of this? I think there are two important implications. The first is that Donald Trump actually thought that he was going to be able, without informing these folks ahead of time, that he was going to broker some sort of detente between the parents of a person killed by this woman and the woman, even though the woman had fled the jurisdiction and was trying to avoid any kind of criminal culpability. And the second, and in some ways even more disturbing tell, was that Trump's national security advisor now, Robert O'Brien, went along with this. Perfectly enabled it and apparently did not impress the parents at all. And this is an extremely disturbing tell for the next 16 months of foreign policy, next 16 to, I guess, 60 months of foreign policy, because we are now operating in a world in which Donald Trump is very unlikely not to be removed from office from the impeachment process, which means at a minimum, he will be president of the United States and in charge of American foreign policy until January 2021. He is doing this with a remarkably depleted foreign policy bench. And the few people that possess significant foreign policy roles, folks like Mike Pompeo or Robert O'Brien, have clearly made the Faustian bargain of not pushing back on Trump in any way whatsoever. And so essentially, any of Donald Trump's whims has the capacity to become foreign policy immediately, including this sort of crazy reality show effort to reconcile Harry Dunn's parents and the wife of this diplomat. My concern is that you are going to see this played out in a wider variety of things. And indeed, we sort of seen this in the way that the Syria situation has metastasized. Because while I grant you, this was never a great situation. You know, this is a thorny issue that the Trump administration inherited. There had always been some tensions in terms of U.S. support for the Kurds and the fact that Turkey is a NATO ally. Nonetheless, if there was any way in which this could have been made worse, Donald Trump managed to do it. And so, unfortunately, my fear is we are likely to see that played out in just about every sphere of American foreign policy.
You wrote a piece this summer, The Beclowning of American Foreign Policy, and Between Despair and Laughter, Let's Choose Laughter This Week. And by the way, I think that's a choice we often make almost on a daily basis. Okay, are we going to laugh about this, or are we going to, you know, just, you know, reach for the antacid? So the term beclowning, and there's so many examples of all of this, and these are, and unfortunately in Syria there are tragic consequences and there are human beings involved, but it does feel it is the fundamental unseriousness of it all, right? I mean the going back to your main thesis about the toddler in chief, who, you know, presides over the free world and who has access to nuclear weapons.
The clowning is, first of all, just a wonderful word. Really enter our discourse a lot more. But I, in some ways, I started talking about this back in 2017. And I think the principal example of it, which was just, it remains absurd to this day, is when the Gulf Cooperation Council decided to impose sanctions on Qatar. Because Qatar hosts Al Jazeera and was seen as the government was seen as somewhat too friendly towards Iran. And one can quibble about those relative issues. But the point is that in imposing the sanctions, they were imposing sanctions in a country where the United States has a rather significant Air Force base. And what was this bizarre sort of scenario unfolded where Donald Trump tweeted support for the GCC embargo. And nonetheless, the Secretary of State at the time, Rex Tillerson, and the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, basically took actions and made statements suggesting we don't support this GCC embargo, which demonstrates the kind of incoherence of American foreign policy under the Trump administration. And it's genuinely dangerous, first, because you want there to be a coherent foreign policy. But at the time, the other thing I pointed out is that whatever you think about Donald Trump's election, you could argue that his election did represent perhaps a substantive critique of what American foreign policy looked like before. And Trump's election, I think, caused some genuine introspection among the folks that are affectionately now termed the blob, which would probably include me, the sort of members of the foreign policy establishment that have staffed administrations, both Democratic and Republican, for the last 7 years. You know, questions about whether or not the sort of traditional brand of liberal internationalism was the right thing to do in this decade, and whether there needed to be a serious rethink. And the problem is that since what the Trump administration has been so beclowning, as it turns out, folks like me don't need to engage in introspection anymore. Because it's very clear that whatever flaws that liberal internationalism has, it's nothing compared, to the creptacular flameouts that we're seeing from the current administration. And so as a result, I think in some ways it's the worst of both worlds, which is this administration's incompetence means that you don't even necessarily have to question some assumptions that maybe should be questioned about American foreign policy going forward.
You've also written about economic statesmanship and how the Trump administration is handling all of that, which is not well.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things about one of the rare areas where I honestly think that the Donald Trump, when he was campaigning and when he got elected, was a little more within the foreign policy mainstream than many of his other issues, was his firm belief that economic statecraft, namely the threat of sanctions, the threat of raising tariffs, you name it, was a form of leverage that would allow him to extract significant concessions from the rest of the world. And indeed, we've seen that on display, both towards allies and towards adversaries. Towards adversaries, we've seen a variety of maximum pressure campaigns against North Korea, against Venezuela, against Iran. Towards China, there's been this sort of trade war that has continued to escalate. And even towards our allies, you saw the U.S. trying to renegotiate NAFTA, trying to renegotiate the U.S.-South Korea free trade agreement, trying to extract concessions from the European Union, and so on and so forth. Indeed, that you could argue there was no major economy that the U.S. did not sanction in the first 3,000 days of the Trump administration. And what is striking is the degree to which they have not gotten that much from all of this. It's telling that the biggest success that I think you can point to for the Trump administration's economic diplomacy was a renegotiation of postal rates in the Universal Postal Union. This was a genuine win for them. I think they renegotiated these postage rates, essentially, which amounted to a very modest subsidy for China. You know, some estimates suggest that this will benefit the United States on the order of a couple hundred million. I don't mean to dismiss that. But that said, you know, the U.S. has gotten nothing from the European Union. They've gotten very modest concessions from South Korea and Mexico, and they have gotten nothing from, or worse than nothing, from China in terms of the trade war. And the maximum pressure campaigns, while successfully imposing significant costs on the North Korean economy, the Iranian economy, and the Venezuelan economy, have not actually led to anything in the way of concessions. And indeed, it's actually exacerbated situations in most of these countries. So as a result, in North Korea, you see Kim Jong-un, despite the three beautiful summits and the beautiful letters that he's sent to Donald Trump, this very morning, continuing to launch ballistic missiles that freak out Japan and South Korea.
And by the way, when did they start referring to those North Korean missiles as projectiles? Did you notice that in the media? They became projectiles.
I think that, yes, because I think that way it potentially one of the more startling things that Trump said when these first started, I think, was his claim of, well, that's OK. It only violates UN Security Council resolutions. It doesn't violate any of my agreements with Kim Jong-un. And, you know, not for nothing, but violating a UN Security Council resolution used to be a pretty big deal in the eyes of U.S. Foreign policy. So and also it generally gives you more. You know, more leverage in terms of dealing with that country. I mean, the problem is that the Trump White House and the Trump administration clearly seems bound and determined to dismiss any of these kinds of violations as ticky-tack and minor. And by the way, that's also how they've responded to Iran's provocations in the Persian Gulf, where they've attacked various tankers or, you know, clearly played a role in the destruction of the Saudi or the explosion of the Saudi Arabian oil facility. And it's also what's happening in Venezuela, where you've seen massive refugee flows, you know, potentially threatening to cause problems in neighboring states like Colombia.
So exactly where are we at in terms of what's happening in Syria? I'm trying to get my head around all of these things. You know, we withdrew from Syria because we didn't want to have the endless wars. And the reports were this morning that, in fact, we're moving tanks back in. Bradley tanks are moving back into Syria. Is there a coherent foreign policy right now, or is it just or are we actually waging war by whim?
Whim's a pretty good description of what's going on. I mean, what's basically happening, and this is unhealthy for a variety of reasons, is that it was very clear that although Donald Trump wanted to get U.S. troops out of Syria, it would be safe to say the Pentagon did not want to do that.
Yes.
And, you know, this is where there get to be very sensitive questions about chain of command and, you know, what point do you obey when do you push back against the commander in chief? When do you accede to his wishes? In some ways, the disturbing element about Donald Trump is that he's so uninformed as a foreign policy president that it enables folks to essentially make arguments to him that might not be the best arguments, but nonetheless get to an outcome that they want anyway. So in the case of Syria, for example, what the Defense Department and what the Pentagon told him was, look, if we get out, there are oil facilities that ISIS previously controlled, and ISIS will control them again, and this will, you know, empower them again. And obviously this threatens Donald Trump because Trump has repeatedly claimed that ISIS is 100% destroyed. So he authorized, you know, U.S. troops to go back in. And I think the famous quote, which also got added to the toddler in chief thread, was something along the lines of one official described it as essentially putting medicine in yogurt.
Yeah.
Much in the same way that you would, you know, feed a baby.
Well, that's exactly. You could sort of imagine the scene where somebody, you know, in the Situation Room writes down the word oil and they slip it to somebody. Just say oil.
Right.
Tell
exactly.
him it's about oil. See what happens. And his eyes lit up, right?
Yes, exactly. And the truly terrifying thing about this is that, you know, and he, I think he tweeted something to the effect of he was going to invite ExxonMobil to extract the oil, which, you know, A, is not, I'm not sure, physically possible, and B, is definitely not legal, since there's no basis for the U.S. to control these oil fields. So
legal, Schmeagle.
I know.
It's Article 2. He can do anything.
But this is how Trump genuinely views the world. And this is something he's been relatively consistent about. I mean, I remember back in 2011 when he was launching his sort of trial balloon on this, claiming what we need to do is go into Iraq and control the oil, which it didn't make sense then. And it doesn't make any sense.
OK, so let's say something positive about the president. Look, we are 4 days away from arguably one of the biggest successes of his presidency. Right. You know, getting al-Baghdadi, cutting off the head of ISIS. The president comes out. He announces this. This is an historic moment. Obviously, a lot of parallels with Barack Obama getting Osama bin Laden. You know, et cetera. And before we get to the more substance of this, I'm not as upset about Doggate as other people. The photoshopping of the hero dog with the president, that the president, putting the medal on the hero dog.
Right.
I mean, I have to admit, I winced when I realized that they had photoshopped an actual recipient of the Medal of Honor. They'd photoshopped him out to put in and replaced his face with a dog, but apparently he's cool with it. He doesn't have a problem with it. It's not that bad. But I mean, this was an unalloyed success for any other president, wasn't it? Any other president?
Yes. For this president, there were two issues that immediately became apparent. The first was, there was no hook from stage left yanking Donald Trump off the stage after he read the scripted announcement, and instead he wound up taking questions and answering press questions for about an hour. And in the process, potentially spilling some operational details that he probably shouldn't have, but also saying things that were clearly not true. And so, again, it's the problem where he can never count out Donald Trump's ability to step on his own victories.
Right. Here's the thing about this that I still find remarkable and so revealing, because this was an absolute victory. There's no question about it on every single level. And yet the president, and even before he got to the question and answer, I think this was in the scripted part, where he's talking about al-Baghdadi, whining and whimpering and,
all of that.
Just makes this up, which is not just apparently a lie, but it's a completely unnecessary lie. I mean, it's one thing to embellish the story, fine. But here the president sit down and he adds something that has no factual basis. He gets nothing more from it except he just can't help himself. I mean, that's where the lying and the embellishment becomes pathological, that even when he has every incentive in the world, keep it straight, tell the truth, because the truth is awesomely good for you, he has to gild it.
One of the awful skills I have developed, and I'm sure you have as well during the Trump years, is that you can tell when he's reading from a teleprompter and when he's freelancing.
When he's riffing, yeah.
Yeah, when he's riffing, because when he's riffing, his voice is actually animated and a lot, he's better at riffing in the sense of his voice gets more animated. Whereas when he reads from a teleprompter, it's this sort of rote, low energy voice. So, you knew when he was saying that thing about Baghdadi that it wasn't in the transcript.
Yeah, but he just felt that the movie wasn't good enough.
Right.
The movie, he's playing the movie in his head, thinking what would make the movie even better. And so he writes it in. And he's always the producer of everything and sees everything in terms of a movie.
Oh, yeah. And this is consistent with, I think, Daniel Dale at CNN has sort of cornered the market on this, where there's a whole series of tropes that Donald Trump does whenever he's sort of vamping like that, where you can tell that there's no basis in fact, like people calling him sir, or, grown hard men crying in front of him because they're overwhelmed with emotion. Generals, constantly, deferring to his military genius, these kinds of things. It's sort of a trope. The other thing I would add, by the way, that the other sort of negative about the Baghdadi raid is that literally less than 12 hours after Trump announced it, there was a story in The New York Times that made it very clear that the reason the military recommended this move at this time was basically that they felt this was their last shot.
Yeah.
That essentially because
window
Trump
was closing.
Had,
yeah.
Right. Because essentially Trump was ordering the withdrawal of U.S. troops, because the Turks were moving in, they had a pretty good idea where Baghdadi was, but essentially the U.S. assets on the ground were about to go away. And so as a result, they recommended this strike, even though it had a much higher risk, I think, than they were ordinarily comfortable with in order to sort of take advantage of a closing window.
And yet every once in a while, the president will tell the truth. It's sort of surprising when it happens. I don't know whether you saw this one tweet. He's at a private fundraiser last night, and he's talking about meeting Steve Scalise's wife after he was shot. You see that? And he says, she, quote, "She cried her eyes out when I met her at the hospital that fateful day. I mean, not many wives would react that way to tragedy. I know mine wouldn't." What?
And so this does allow one to develop a sort of grand unified theory of Trump's failure to understand basic human emotion, if you think about it, because this is of a piece with the story about the Dunns, where he thought it was a legitimately good idea to spring a surprise on the parents of this, the grieving parents of this kid who was killed, thinking that if he could spontaneously reunite or bring in this woman, that everyone would get along. You know, the quote that you just read does lead me to wonder, to what extent does, you know, Trump's entire family dynamics are so bizarre that he has such a poor theory of mind that it simply occurs to him that everyone must behave the same way that his own family behaves.
It really is striking that, you know, we've all joked about, you know, shamelessness being his superpower, which I think is now obvious, but also his complete lack of empathy. And I mean, it's rare to find somebody, you know, in I don't know, you know, in this prominently, who will basically acknowledge they have no idea how other people feel and they really don't care.
No, speaking of
that, it's a complete blank spot for him.
Speaking of things that go down the memory hole, I think the highlight, the best example of this was, if you recall, there was a meeting in the White House where Trump is sitting at the Resolute desk, and I believe it was the Yazidis who had won the Nobel Peace Prize. And it's this awful, you know, thing where this woman is trying to explain to Trump what has happened to her, you know,
in
people,
very
her family.
Dramatic terms, very animated.
Right. And it's clear that Trump's mind is wandering, because at one point he then asks her, "So what happened to your family?" And she has to repeat that they've all been killed.
No, she's where is your family? He asks.
Yeah. Where is your family?
Where's your family?
Right.
They're dead.
Yes. And even Trump realizes that's probably not a good moment for him. But like he's just trying to get through the meeting without, you know, as quickly as possible. And yes, that's an example of the lack of empathy and the lack of shame in some ways. And this is one thing he's clearly passed down to his children. The other clip that I couldn't believe last night was, I don't know if you saw this.
I love this. Yeah.
Donald Trump Jr. Talking on Sean Hannity's show, saying that he was really grateful. It must be excruciating to be Hunter Biden and, you know, only making money by trading in on your father's name. I genuinely marvel at the lack of self-awareness that one must possess to be able to say that line if you're Donald Trump Jr.
Or yes, I agree with you. Or it's just that they've decided that they're going to use the Jedi mind trick. They're just going to just totally scramble our mind. Actually, I have a morning newsletter, and I made that my first item. I usually don't do that. And I headline that as "Irony is Dead, Chapter Bazillion." Donald Trump Jr. "I wish I was like Hunter Biden, so I could make millions off of my father's presidency."
Oh my God!
I mean, it's just like I'm sorry. Just, you know, beat me to death with hammers right now.
No, to be fair, though, probably in all likelihood, Donald Trump Jr. has lost millions of dollars, you know, trying to manage Donald Trump's property. So maybe that's what's actually going on.
The guy is a retromingent hack. Yes. I use the word retromingent because we have to start coming up with new words for these people. Retromingent actually means backward urinating. I'm not sure which context it's appropriate in, but it sounded good when I said it in my head.
As a
Donald Trump Jr.,
always,
a retromingent hack.
It's good to learn new words like this, you know. So thank you. I've learned something.
I'm going
to
try that out with Chris Matthews. See what he says. So I just want to get his reaction. Daniel Dresner, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it very, very much.
It was a pleasure. Look forward to it.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.